I'm Suzanne Lang, and I bring you a novel idea. Earlier in the year, I was introduced to an up-and-coming writer from Chicago, New York Times best-selling author Samira Ahmed, with her novel, Love, Hate, and Other Filters. And I've wanted to speak with her ever since. In just a minute, I will bring you my recent conversation with her. Later in the show, we will delve into audiobooks with Robin Witten, editor and founder of Audiophile magazine. Stay with us. It's a novel idea. Samira Ahmed was born in Bombay, India, and grew up in Batavia, Illinois. She has taught high school English and worked to create over 70 small high schools in New York City, where she fought to secure equitable funding for public schools throughout the state. Her young adult novel, Love, Hate, and Other Filters, made many top 10 lists for its mix of honesty and romance, while exposing the reality that many young Muslim Americans experience. It's a raw look at the cultural realities of violence and prejudice, as well as the coming of age of a young woman. Let's listen to our conversation. Samira Ahmed, Love, Hate, and Other Filters is a book that was released earlier this year, and I've been wanting to talk to you about it for a while. It is so present to our lives today and certainly to the lives of young people. And it's geared towards a young adult audience, and on the surface, it's about an American girl who just wants to go to film school and kiss a boy. But she's just not any American girl. She's a Muslim. She has brown skin, and her parents are from India. And she lives in a pretty much white area outside of Chicago. So tell us a little bit about your desire to tell her story first.
Well, first, thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it. You know, Maya's story to me is just how you described it. I mean, she's just an American girl, you know, who wants to pursue her dreams and, you know, has a crush on a boy, things that you just think of as a regular part of, you know, teenage existence, you know, kids who are on the cusp of going to college and stepping into adulthood. But her life is, you know, infinitely more complex than just those simple phrases, because, as you say, she is an Indian American Muslim, the only one in her small, almost totally white town. And she comes face to face with Islamophobia in a way that she hasn't before. She's always lived with it, kind of the underpinnings of it, the sort of microaggressions of it, the difficulty of, like, just going to an airport and having, you know, and the difficulty of having people just assume that you can't be American because you're brown or because your name sounds quote-unquote funny. But she comes face to face with Islamophobia in a much more violent way in this novel. And part of the reason I wanted to write that story, her story, is because I really wanted to capture a moment in childhood when life is shattered. You know, despite her awareness of what it means to be, you know, a person of color living in America today, and facing, you know, racism, there are some things that you can never really be prepared for, no matter what you know or how wise you are you know, what people tell you. Because when it's the first time being confronted with that kind of violent bigotry, it is shocking and, you know, it can shatter your worldview. And I wanted to write a story about this young woman who has to grapple with that and at the same time is grappling with just the everyday things of, you know, of life as a teenager growing up, and how those two meet and affect one another. And, you know, it's a very real world situation for millions of kids in America today. So I wanted to tell that story.
It absolutely is so real. Her story, and it's narrated by her. She's the narrator. But we also learn about the life of another young man as well, mm-hmm. and not as broadly, but almost as intimately, and the effects his family life have on him and his element, his participation in this cultural moment is a little bit different from hers. And so you structure the book so that we have this building momentum of these two lives. And from the authorial point of view, how did you make some of those decisions to do it?
You know, so the novel follows, of course, Maya is telling us her story, but at the same time, there are interstitial chapters which follow an act of domestic terrorism as it occurs. I was kind of inspired to do these interstitial chapters really by two different books that I'd read. One is The Grapes of Wrath, where Steinbeck uses these interstitial chapters to give us insights into, you know, the main narrator to the story of the Joads. And, you know, for example, you have an interstitial chapter about literally a turtle crossing a road, getting a rock stuck in its shell. And you know, initially you might be thinking, why is Steinbeck stopping this journey of the Joads to tell us about a turtle crossing the road? And then you can see why he does that as you read further on. So I wanted to have these interstitial chapters give insight into Maya's, you know, larger narrative. And also, like I said, kind of catch the reader in the same way, you know, Maya is caught up in what happens to her. And I also wanted to create a certain tone with those interstitial chapters, which I couldn't create just in Maya's first-person narrative. And so that's why I chose third-person omniscient for those interstitial chapters. And the tone of it was really inspired just by a single sentence from Truman Capote's In Cold Blood, which I think, you know, I probably am not giving any spoilers here, mm-hmm. We all know that it's about, you know, these terrible murders that happen in Kansas. We know what the outcome is going to be. And yet Capote still is able to build this incredible tension. And I remember reading just one sentence in that book where the murderers are awaiting, you know, for the lights to go down in the Clutter family house, for night to descend. And, you know, they're sitting on the side of a gravel road, and the reader absolutely knows what's going to happen because it's a historical fact. And yet you don't want the next thing to happen. And so when the murderers are sitting there on the side of the road, and the moment comes for them to move, Capote just writes this very simple sentence where he says, "Presently, the car crept forward." And I remember just being astonished by such a simple sentence. And yet my reaction as the reader was, you know, immediately, no, don't creep forward. You want something to happen to that car. I really don't know anything about car mechanics, but you want the engine to fall out or the carburetor to fail or whatever would prevent that murder from happening, because you know it's going to be horrible. And you just really have a visceral reaction to that. And so I wanted to try to create this really ominous tone, which was inspired by that Capote sentence, within these interstitial chapters, which were kind of inspired by The Grapes of Wrath.
Interesting. I mean, that's an interesting kind of genesis to that. Yet it serves the function in your book of really building tension, that we sense something's going to happen, but we don't know what. And also to expose this counterpoint to her, or at least that's what it did to me, that mm-hmm. there's this other young man, and he has an identity, and he has a life, but it goes in a very different direction from Maya's.
I try to make all the characters as three-dimensional as possible because, you know, I always think that the most terrifying monsters are, you know, the ones, you know, the ones that are real. And they weren't just born that way. Something created the circumstance and the moment and everything else that led this person to do something, you know, heinous and horrible. And I was not trying necessarily to have, you know, sympathy so much for that character, but just to say every person comes from a place, and those places and things that happen in our life do affect us, and we have choices that we can make, and sometimes our choices lead us down very different paths. And so I wanted to show that character fully as well, not as an excuse for their behavior, but rather as kind of an unpacking of an individual and the path that life leads him on, and also the choices that he makes.
Well, we'll let our readers find out more about that. But I do want to mention one other thing about that, that your use of, you know, Maya's in high school, and part of the other young man, Ethan Branson's past, is also as a student. And you bring in a Walt Whitman poem that there was just something about placing it there and the way you did that, that I found myself reading and rereading that poem over and over again. And I don't know, I just thought it was an interesting choice you made, and that it was very affecting for me as the reader.
Well, I think in that Whitman poem, you know, there's this idea, you know, that we're all going to contribute a verse to kind of this larger story. And I think as, you know, teenagers and adults, or, you know, whatever, I think there's this very important question that we should keep asking ourselves, which is, what will my verse be? And, you know, both of the characters, all of the characters in the novel are asking themselves that verse. I mean, that question, what will my verse be? What is the contribution that I'm going to make? And I think, you know, you can have very different answers to that question. And I hope it's a question that, you know, teenagers and, like I said, adults continue to ask themselves, you know, what is my verse going to be? Sometimes that verse is going to change. Sometimes your answer is going to lead you down a path that you didn't realize it was going to take you down. And you have the ability, hopefully, to change that if you want to. Sometimes you realize you're going to have a lot of answers to that question, and maybe you're going to try to pursue many of them. And, you know, both for Maya and the other characters in the novel, that's a question that they're grappling with. What will my verse be? You know, even one of her love interest, Phil, is asking himself that question. There's certain expectations that are put on him, just like there are put on Maya. But he's trying to find that answer for himself. Well, what is my verse going to be? What is my role going to be? What am I going to contribute? What is the thing that moves me? And it's not necessarily the answer that everyone expects him to give.
Yes. And Maya herself, she has a very strong vision of, well, and she has a strong vision literally of how she sees the world and how she captures mm-hmm. the world. And she uses her camera to explore the world. And that's what she wants to do. And she's pretty darn clear about that. But it's in contrast to, like many 17-year-olds, to what her parents want for her. And so that's a kind of central conflict in the book as well. But lest this, I paint this as a heavy and dark book, it really is also a very satisfying, I'm going to say, teen read, in that she is a young girl who is exploring love and both from the cultural perspective of her parents wanting a good match for her, and her own yearnings and awakening sexuality.
Well, yes, I mean, it's a coming-of-age novel, you know, and like I said, Maya is just a regular girl who unfortunately has all of these other things that kind of are interfering with just what would be like just a regular coming-of-age story, I guess. But, you know, I loved exploring that part, too, because I really enjoy writing about those, you know, those realizations about yourself, and really even like the first time, like first love, you know, like exploring your passion, that she, like the passion she has for filmmaking. And I think, you know, it's just so wonderful to be able to capture that kind of that first crush or first love feel, for example. And, you know, it's something that you can never exactly replicate, but it's a feeling that many of us know and perhaps kind of look at with some nostalgia, or if you're experiencing it for the first time, you know, it's this kind of effervescent feeling that you kind of hope you can capture forever. And I think it's just wonderful to be able to, as a writer, to try to capture a little bit of that, at least on the page. It's just part of the beauty of human experience, you know? And so I wanted to capture a wealth of those experiences for Maya. And because she is a filmmaker and because she wants to pursue her passion for filmmaking, she is a very keen observer, both of the world around her, and is trying to become a more, you know, nuanced observer of her own self. So I really, you know, I really enjoyed sort of the interplay of those, you know, those discoveries, like the discovery of the self and the discovery of her world as Maya is going on this journey.
There was a chapter between she and Phil, somebody she has a big crush on, and he is teaching her how to float in the water. And that chapter was satisfying and really did take me back to a time when, first of all, as a young reader, reading these types of books was something that I think it must be challenging for you, for any writer, to get those tones just right, that they do, just as you say, either bring back a sense of that for the reader or draw you in as that young teenage reader who is living in that world right now.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that was a really fun chapter to write. I think because, you know, like I said, I was trying to write it through Maya's, you know, it's through Maya's point of view, and she's ever the observer. And, you know, all of these little things happening, and they're like the ripple on the water and the droplets falling on, you know, Phil's skin and the light filtering through the trees. I mean, she has a very filmic imagination, and I tried to capture it that way. And I think for a lot of us who've already had that experience, you know, as a writer, you know, I'm a middle-aged writer, not a teenager, but I, you know, a lot of times our memory is captured in that filmic way. We're almost outside of ourselves watching the memory, if that makes sense. And so I think that's how I try to sort of capture it on the page. It's happening in the moment, you know, and Maya is in the moment. And yet, because she also, you know, is forever documenting her life and uses the camera as sort of her filter through which she sees the world, I wanted to sort of also create that kind of what would become sort of the filmic memory in her mind. And so it was really, you know, really enjoyable to sort of be in that rich moment with Maya and Phil.
And that's a good way of putting it, that she does kind of see the world through a certain lens, and but it doesn't always go the way she would have it if it were an actual movie. And and she also has what one might say is the typical teenage or relationship with her mom, that they're kind of always butting heads, but that's then there's this whole cultural thing of her mother wanting a certain type of life for her daughter, and we should say that Maya is a first generation American, and that her parents came from India. So talk a little bit about that kind of dynamic, because I think that that is a real situation, and in our current cultural moment, I think it's right at the top of our conversations.
Right. Well, I'm going to unpack that question in a couple ways. So first, I think that the experience of being a teenager and that relationship with your parents is a naturally dramatic place to live. I mean, I think, you know, the job of the parent is to really give your child the, you know, the tools and skills they need to live completely independent from you, to be successful without you, in a way. And yet at the same time, for the parent, that creates such incredible internal turmoil, which is you want to keep that child, your baby, so close, and yet you know they have to step away from you to really become fully independent adults in a lot of ways. You know, they're not always going to be able to be in your nest. And for Maya and for many teens, I think, you know, that's where a lot of the tension and struggle between headbutting, as you say, comes in, where, you know, they have their hopes and dreams and expectations. And yes, they love their parents, but at the same time, you know, they're bristling against that desire that parents have to keep them close, even though they know they have to, you know, let them spread their wings. So I think that's kind of a natural, you know, and fascinating dynamic that exists between all teens and parents, regardless of, you know, sort of the culture they're coming from. But then Maya does, there's that interplay also with the cultural dynamic of her parents being, you know, Indian immigrants. And, you know, I think the immigrant experience in America is incredibly diverse and rich, and, you know, it's not a monolith. But I do think that, you know, for immigrants to come to this country, what they're doing is, you know, they're literally uprooting themselves and trying to replant themselves, you know, as fully formed adults in many cases, in you know, new soil, in a place that can feel very foreign and can feel very othering. And I think many, you know, immigrant parents really just want to create as stable a life for themselves and their children as possible. I think as all parents do, but I think that's sometimes where some of the some bits of those tensions come about. You know, where, you know, I joke around with some of my other Indian American or some of my Asian American friends about like the desire of our parents for us to become doctors. When, you know, for example, in India, it's not just a population of 1 billion doctors, but or, you know, lawyers or engineers, but there is a kind of sort of stability and I guess respect accorded to that. And in the parents' minds, in Maya's parents' minds, you know, it gives her something that she will always be able to hang on to and be able to have, and a foundation and a kind of power that they think she won't have if she pursues her dreams of being, you know, a filmmaker, which they see, you know, as being kind of unstable and risky and taking a chance. And they don't necessarily want their daughter to take those risks, even though they themselves took a huge risk in coming to America. So that, I think, creates an interesting dynamic and friction between, you know, the immigrant and their children as well. And the foundation of it is love, but at the same time, you know, it can be sometimes trying situation because, you know, her immigrant parents grew up in a completely different environment. They weren't the other where they were growing up. And they see them, you know, they see in a very real way how Maya and they are othered in this country. And so I think there's a natural desire to put your child kind of in, you know, in bubble wrap to protect yes. them from the terrible things that they see can happen.
And she does not want to be bubble wrapped at all, not at all. And also some of the blurbs and comments about this book are that it is noted for featuring a Muslim characters at the center of it. And I guess, why is that so unusual? Is it hard for books with, especially maybe young adult novels or whatever, to, why aren't we seeing more mainstream literature with Muslims as characters?
Well, I mean, I think we, you know, in young adult fiction, we do have some great, you know, Muslim American writers, Aisha Saeed and S.K. Ali, Saba Tahir, Tahereh Mafi, whose book was long listed for the National Book Award, featuring a young Muslim, you know, hijabi girl protagonist, A Very Wide Expanse of Feet, which is an amazing, incredible novel. And so we do have some of them, you know, being published. But I think that, you know, number one, for a long time, publishing, especially children's publishing, has not been very open to diverse titles. I mean, even still, the representation of, you know, Black American kids in books is so limited, and
yes.
many of the authors aren't even Black themselves. So there, I believe, are statistics that say that it's easier for a Black child, for example, to find a book with a talking animal as a protagonist than it is for them to find a book with a child that looks like them. And, you know, I'm really a believer, a big believer, that our shelves should reflect our world. And when you put a book into the hands of a child, regardless of their age, I think it is so important. It's so formative for them. And I think it's critical for publishing and for, you know, our sort of larger culture in general, movies and TV shows, to depict really the vast array of experiences of Muslim Americans in this country and of immigrants in this country and of Black Americans in this country. I mean, there's so often just the stereotypes of, well, a Muslim is a terrorist. And, you know, Maya talks about that in the novel. And, you know, it's when, you know, sort of the powers that be see that as kind of the main narrative, straying from that narrative can be really hard. But we've been making a lot of inroads. There's a wonderful organization called We Need Diverse Books, which has really been, you know, out there on the forefront pushing this idea that, you know, every child deserves to see themselves as a hero in a book. And I think that's so, so important, you know, to be able to imagine yourself in all these incredible roles, you know, whether it's as, you know, a superhero or a girl going to film school or, you know, whatever the case may be, just not as a stereotype. I mean, I think it is just so culturally important for our children and our country. And, you know, it's also important for kids who have perhaps never met a Muslim. Maybe they live in a town where there's no Muslim kids who live. I mean, like, you know, the Muslim population in the United States is only about 2%. And I think it's important for those kids to have diverse books in their classrooms and in their bookshelves, too, because that's the world that we live in. And, you know, reading can build an empathy for someone that perhaps you've never met. Because when you read Maya's story, you know, these experiences that Maya has of falling in love and, you know, arguing with her parents and having a dream and persisting even against the odds and having people put, you know, expectations on her that she doesn't necessarily agree with and standing up to a bully. These are all experiences that are pretty, you know, global in the sort of larger teen narrative. And so I think knowing that and seeing that you can see part of your own experience reflected in this character that is maybe different than you, I think is really important. So I think, you know, a book can be a mirror where a child who's reading it can see a part of their experience reflected back at them. And it can also be a window for a child who doesn't look at all like that main character, but it gives them a little window into another life. And they can see that, hey, you know what? Part of looking through this window is that I can see some of my experiences reflected in this character who at first glance seems really different than me. But we have this shared and common humanity. And I think it's so important for that to be part of our larger, you know, conversation. Yes. About books and literature in schools and in our libraries and, you know, in our bookstores.
Yes, yes. Because I want to go to film school too, and I want to kiss a boy too, and some things are common across the way. I'm talking with Samira Ahmed. The book is Love, Hate, and Other Filters, and I understand you have another book coming out maybe in 2019. Is that anything you want to tell us about?
I have a book coming out in March 2019, and it's called Internment. And it follows the story of a young Muslim American girl growing up in a near future America. We call it a novel set 15 minutes into the future, where an authoritarian president has come to power, and he begins to institute exclusion laws that separate Muslims based on their religious identity, and then starts imprisoning Muslims in the first internment camps for Muslim Americans in this country. And it follows the story of a young girl and her family who are amongst the first wave of Muslims who are put into internment camps, and how she tries to stand up and resist and fight back against both, you know, silent complicity that can create this kind of situation, and also against the very real authoritarian figures in the camp. So, you know, fighting for her faith and her life and for a country that she really believes in and knows can be better. And that comes out March 2019 in Internment, and it was recently optioned for a film. So we'll see how that turns out. Fingers crossed for that one.
Congratulations.
And I have another book coming out in January 2020 called Mad, Bad, and Dangerous to Know, which is actually quite different from the first two novels. It's a literary mystery, that's January 2020.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, and we'll look forward to Internment coming out after the new year, and I wish you all the best.
Thank you so much for having me today.
My conversation with Samira Ahmed on her YA novel, Love, Hate, and Other Filters. As Samira mentioned, she soon will release another book, Internment, which has been optioned for a motion picture. Someone to watch, Samira Ahmed. Let's take a short break with the Fred Hirsch Ensemble's rendition of Walt Whitman's Song of Myself from Leaves of Grass. When we return, I'll talk with Robin Witten from Audiophile Magazine on what else? Audiobooks. I'm Suzanne Lang. It's a novel idea.
A child said, "What is the grass? Fetching it to me with full hands." How could I answer the child? I do not know what it is any more than he. I guess it must be the flag of my disposition, out of hopeful green stuff woven. Or I guess it is the handkerchief of the Lord, a scented gift and remembrancer designedly dropped. Or I guess the grass is itself a child. And now it seems to me the beautiful uncut hair of graves. I am of young and old, of the foolish as much as the wise. Regardless of others, ever regardful of others, maternal as well as paternal, a child as well as a man, stuffed with the stuff that is coarse, and stuff with the stuff that is fine. One of the nations of many nations, the smallest the same, and the largest the same.
That was the Fred Hirsch Ensemble, and A Child Said, "What is the Grass?" Many of us are regular readers of books, but as many of us listen to books in our cars, at the gym, or while walking the dog. Audiophile magazine has been around since 1992, reviewing audiobooks, first as a magazine, and now, of course, with a website, blog postings, and a podcast to help listeners and readers discover the world of audiobooks. They even give Audi Awards, and this year's include the audiobooks of Lincoln in the Bardo and Bruce Springsteen's memoir, Born to Run. Robin Witten is the founder and editor of Audiophile, and here is our conversation. Robin Witten, you are the editor and founder of Audiophile Magazine on audiophilemagazine.com. And tell us a little bit about that publication first before we go deep on audiobooks.
Well, Suzanne, thank you. I would love to talk a little bit about Audiophile. We review and recommend audiobooks. We don't sell them. We just talk about them and try to find good recommendations for listeners from the thousands of audiobooks that are published every year. and we do it in print. On our website, we have newsletters, and we also have a brand new podcast. But we've been listening to audiobooks since the 1990s, when I started the magazine as a newsletter.
I think that, and I'm going to ask you about this, that there are probably some of our listeners who maybe tend more towards audiobooks. I suppose people listen to audiobooks maybe at the gym or in the car, or because they enjoy that more. And there are probably some people who just haven't been exposed or don't expose themselves to audiobooks. And it seems like it's a whole deep world out there. So what do you know about who listens to audiobooks?
Well, I think what is evolving over time with listeners is that there are kind of two big factors in why people listen initially, I guess. And that would be traveling, all different kinds of conveyances, but mostly vehicles, and busy lives. Those two things are factors that affect how much reading time we have. And I think that for most listeners are readers, and they are looking for more time to read. And because we're tied up in traffic or, you know, want to get to the gym, take the dog for a walk, and all the other things in our lives, we want to make some extra reading time.
I do notice that there's a whole range of books. I mean, there's nonfiction and fiction. There's historical books, scientific books, and, of course, novels. And it does seem that the narration, the reader, how the book is produced might affect things. I noticed on your website you had a review of a Rock Hudson book, All That Heaven Allows by Mark Griffin. And, well, the first part of the review said, while Mark Griffin's carefully researched story is not very enjoyable in the usual sense because of the multi-layered sadness, Jeremy Arthur's skillful narration makes the biography quite moving. And so, to me, that implies that this book may actually work better as an audiobook. And is that something you find?
I think that does happen. And I think especially to me, the narration, what the narrator brings to the whole experience, you know, is often a make or break kind of situation. And in just what our reviewer was saying, that somehow the oral telling of this biography and of Rock Hudson's life, it was more affecting and powerful as an audio listening experience. Something about what Jeremy Arthur brought to understanding the author's intent was just conveyed really movingly and powerfully in the audio format.
And I imagine, likewise, there are some books that maybe either don't work well as an audiobook, or maybe their production values aren't as good, or the narrator is maybe flat or something like that.
Exactly. And that's certainly why, you know, that was the whole premise of Audiophile in the beginning, is that we wanted to celebrate great performances and, you know, say we review a lot, you know, titles that are in the news and people want to know about. And we try to really evaluate and focus on that audio performance. What is the listening experience going to be? Is it going to elevate the book? Is it, you know, going to rivet you, or are you just kind of going along and hoping you don't fall asleep while the story goes on, or lose your place, you know, lose track of what's going on, which is sometimes people get distracted. If the performance is not really engaging, that can happen.
And, you know, I wondered if there were stars, like, oh, so-and-so's narrated this book?
Well, there are. In recent years, some of the publishers have hired celebrities. And, you know, that often helps to bring people to an audiobook that they might, a great example of that is Sissy Spacek, who narrates To Kill a Mockingbird. Mm. Not that people wouldn't be drawn to Kill a Mockingbird anyway, but I think her celebrity perhaps attracted people who said, oh, I read that years ago, but maybe I'd like to listen to her do this. But they're also that's a little bit of a one-time thing. She has other opportunities besides narrating audiobooks. So I think celebrities often will do a specific title once or maybe twice. But the industry of audiobook narrators, we definitely have stars. Golden voices, as Audiophile likes to call a couple dozen narrators who have a lifetime of creating amazing audio experiences. Simon Vance is one of the narrators. Scott Brick is another LA-based audiobook narrator who's had an amazing career across. We always think that it's good that a narrator can narrate many types of books, whether they're doing a biography or a piece of science fiction, or they're good. Anything that they get, they're pretty terrific with.
And so that's what your magazine exposes us to, is this kind of range of information about the audiobooks and the audiobook industry. Now, I also wondered, and I'm going to ask you to give us some recommendations in a few minutes, but that, like, right now Michelle Obama's book is big, and she's narrated her own book, and that must sometimes be tricky for the author who may or may not represent their own work well, whether it's fiction or nonfiction. But can you talk a little bit about that, the author reading their own work?
Yes, it's interesting. I think when an author, gets behind the mic, it can be a mixed result. An author does their best work if they're doing a memoir, and Michelle Obama's Becoming is a perfect example of that, partially because of the way she wrote her memoir and partially because she brings all the sort of passion and intimacy that is written into the memoir to her narration. I mean, it's a natural fit. And if you hear her, you wonder, why would I want to read that on a page when she's just told you about it? And so that's a great example of where an author can succeed. Oftentimes, authors are maybe less successful with fiction, simply because I think it being a narrator, even of your own work, is harder than an author might think. And we've heard this numerous times with authors who say, oh, it's my book, I'll narrate it. But then when you have, a director and an engineer correcting your pronunciation of something, and going over it and not, trying to get every word right, I mean, it takes a lot longer than the author's might think. It also is quite different from maybe a 10-minute segment at a book launch or bookstore a presentation where the author is talking about their books, and you know they read a little bit. That always sounds great. It's so interesting. But if they're going to do that, have to do that for hours, there's a lot of skill that may not be immediately apparent that the audiobook narrators bring to that.
I think that, you know, I've had authors in here reading from their own book, and sometimes, you know, it's a passage they've read many times, and they still can't get through it without stumbling. I don't mean it as a criticism, only a reality that when you're reading text, sometimes it's not as straightforward as you think.
Right.
Yeah. Yes.
Right. And certainly I've discovered this having just started our little podcast of Behind the Mic. It's like, if you're talking, don't try to read exactly what you put in your notes, because I always stumble over it.
Yeah, I hear you on that one. Ditto. And I also wondered, you know, there are a lot of small presses and indeed self-published books. And I wondered if there's such a thing as a small press audiobooks, or are there authors who are actually producing their own audiobooks?
There are, and we pay special attention and are always interested in independent authors who have produced an audiobook, and there are a couple different systems, programs that where an author can get their audiobook produced. But we're always interested because, you know, we want to give them an even chance of, you know, getting a review. And it's always a delight when we find something that one of our reviewers is very excited about from an independent author, because we feel like we've really made a great discovery. You know, we may be the first people in on this kind of thing.
yeah. And what is that relationship between audiobooks and hard copy paper books in kind of the economics of it? Is the audiobook published by somebody else, produced by somebody else, not connected with the book industry? And sales-wise, like, say, for instance, let's use Michelle Obama's book. Would the audio sales be equal to the book sales, a third, a fifth, something like that?
I don't really know.
Okay, all right.
But I do know that audiobook sales are having, you know, audiobooks are a little bit of a darling in publishing at the moment, because the audiobook sales are growing at a phenomenal rate. And in the last 5 years, they've had double-digit, like 20% plus increases in sales every year. So not the other formats of hardcover or ebooks, I don't think, are enjoying that kind of growth.
Interesting.
So that is very exciting from my point of view, that more and more people are choosing the audio format as an alternative. Maybe, you know, I really, really want to read Michelle Obama's book, but, you know, I'm in the car all the time. Ah, an audio book. That's the solution. And, of course, we think that's a better form of experiencing her book. But, you know, the industry is having terrific growth, and there were 46,000 audiobooks published in 2017. So that's still a small proportion of all books that are published, but that's again a big increase from maybe even 5 years ago.
I'm talking with Robin Witten. She's the editor and founder of Audiophile Magazine, and audiophilemagazine.com is the website. And Robin, can you just maybe leave us with some recommendations of books that you think people might like to listen to?
I would be delighted to. Well, we've been talking about Becoming by Michelle Obama, and it's read by the author, so that is an excellent choice. Another fiction that I've been excited about this year is Circe by Madeline Miller, and it is read by the lovely British actress Perdita Weeks, and that is the retelling of the Greek myth of Circe. We've also liked Warlight by Michael Ondaatje, read by another Brit, Steve West, which is an interesting look, very historical fiction look at just after the war, or actually during World War II. In maybe science fiction, we have really liked Who is the Black Panther, which is, now this is an interesting audiobook for anyone who likes big productions. This has got a lot of sound and sound effects, like a big radio drama. And it's a Who is the Black Panther is by Jesse J. Holland, and it is performed by a full cast. Yeah. So that with Stan Lee in the news lately, mm-hmm. and remembering all the wonderful work that he did, that's kind of a fun recommendation.
Well, thank you so much, Robin. I hope people check out your website, especially for getting good recommendations and being exposed to this broader world of audiobooks. Thanks so much, Robin.
Thank you, Suzanne. Pleasure.
My conversation with Robin Witten of Audiophile magazine. Earlier in the broadcast, I spoke with Samira Ahmed on her novel, Love, Hate, and Other Filters. And her upcoming book is Internment. I thank you for listening today. Subscribe to our podcast at norcalpublicmedia.org and listen to past shows as well. Sean Knight, Mark Prell, and Anthony Garcia help with production. We'll go out with Bruce Springsteen, whose memoir, Born to Run, is an Audiophile Award winner, and this is from his Broadway production, Springsteen on Broadway. I'm Suzanne Lang with a novel idea.
In the day we sweated out on the streets of a runaway American dream. At night we ride through mansions of glory in suicide machines. We'll sprung from cages on Highway 9, chrome wheel fuel injected and 7 out over the line. Maybe this town rips the bones from your back. It's a death trap, it's suicide rap. We gotta get out while we're young. Us tramps like us, baby, we were born to run. When did you let me in? I wanna be your friend. I wanna guard your dreams and visions. Yeah, just wrap your legs around these velvet rims. Strap your hands across my engines, and together this trap, we'll run till we drop, and we'll never go back. Walk with me out on the wire, 'cause I'm just a scared and lonely rider. I gotta find out how it feels. I wanna know if love is wild. I wanna know if love is real. Palace hemi-powered drones scream down the boulevard. The girls comb their hair in rear-view mirrors, and the boys try to look so hard. The amusement park rises bold and stark. Kids are huddled on the beach in the mist. I'm gonna die with you, Wendy, on the street tonight.
in an everlasting kiss. The highway's jammed with broken heroes on a last chance power drive. Everybody's out on the run tonight, but there's no place left to hide. So together, Wendy, we'll live with the sadness. I'll love you with all the madness in my soul. Someday, girl, I don't know when we're gonna get to that place where we really wanna go, and we'll walk in the sun, telling tramps like us, baby, we were born to run. Whoa, 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 whoa.
Bruce Springsteen, Born to Run, from Springsteen on Broadway. You've been listening to KRCB's A Novel Idea.